From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for September 18th, 2016. It's a special weekend for the show. It's been a crazy political week, and what a week for the Cubs. Well, we'll quickly get you up to speed on all the latest in the world of politics, so grab that Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. First off, I want to say a very, very special thank you to all of you, the listeners of the Sunday Spin. And that's from all of us here at the show, Dave, Sam, Jasmine, and Bob. This, Dave, is our third anniversary of the Sunday Spin.
Already?
Yes. And I'm very thankful to all of you out there who have made us part of your Sunday morning wake-up call. We're the number one show for the time slot on radio here in Chicago. And thank you for allowing us into your lives. And how about that, Dave? 3 years.
I was going to say, time does fly, and we are having fun.
We are having fun.
Because if we weren't having fun, we wouldn't be here on this hour on a Sunday morning.
That's for sure. But no.
That's fantastic.
This has been great. And yes, time really does fly. You know, it's and we talk about that all the time, but you know, here we are. This is what, the last week of the summer,
last weekend. Thursday is the formally called the autumnal equinox. So, Thursday's the
wasn't
day.
Wasn't that a horse in the Derby? that or maybe a giant starting pitcher. I'm not sure. It's
autumnal equinox ahead by three lengths.
Oh, but yes, thank you again, everybody. Thanks so much.
Here comes lunar eclipse around the corner.
That would be my bet, probably, on lunar eclipse. Yeah, lunar eclipse to show would be the bet. Oh, man. But
no, really, is it 3 years?
Yes, it is.
That has gone fast.
Yes, but Dave, and thank you. I mean, you really help make this show what it is.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's wonderful to be here to do this. You know, and you did exactly the right thing by thanking our listeners first with that, because we wouldn't be here if they weren't here either. So.
That's true as well. So, again, thank you, everybody. Enough about the show. How about those Cubbies, you know?
Yeah.
I actually made the mistake of staying up late on Thursday night to watch the Cardinals lose to the Giants, to watch the Cubs kind of back into the...
Oh, did you stay up for the duration of this?
Yeah, it was like 11:45 at night.
Yeah, it was a late night.
But still, it was worth it. It was absolutely worth it. And, you know, then on Friday, the Cubs came back and took off on the Brew Crew. Yesterday, who cares, right? But today...
That was a surprising outcome, though.
It was, especially with Arrieta pitching.
Right.
But, you know, you got to figure a little relief valve action after, you know, watching the magic number tick, 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 tick. And there is still another magic number, you know.
Yes.
For a home field advantage.
Home field advantage. And we are still very much into the regular season.
8 is the magic number for home field advantage. That's the combination of Cubs wins and the Washington Nationals losses. They're the rival for the home field.
The rival for a home field? Okay.
So, but, I mean, we could just make that an easy one if we can just get a nice victory at Wrigley Field today.
I think we can do that. Well, I think after being hit yesterday, 11-3, the final score, I think they're going to come back.
I think so, too. I think it'd be a great day to be at the ballpark today, Dave. What do you think?
Well, you know what? That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
How about you and I go out to Wrigley today?
Let's work on that. Let's work on that.
Yeah, that certainly wasn't pre-planned
at all. I need to place my bet for a lunar eclipse or autumnal equinox first here.
Well, I'll tell you, too, what's been interesting over this weekend is seeing the number of Philadelphia Eagles fans.
I think I saw some of them on my way into work this morning.
It would figure, right? And what time would that be?
That was 4 a.m.
Yeah, that would be the approximate time you would see Philadelphia Eagles fans, because they're a unique bunch, Philadelphia sports fans. And I was going to tweet out something that said, "Welcome to Chicago, Philadelphia Eagles fans. We understand you're here because you want to see what a real city looks like." But I didn't, I didn't tweet that.
Now
out,
you just said it on a 50,000-watt radio station.
Yes,
I
realize
can
that.
Be heard in Philadelphia.
I understand
and streamed
that, yes.
Around the world, Rick.
I'm not going to take it back. But, yeah, the Bears playing the Eagles on Monday Night Football at home here in Chicago. And that always makes for an interesting trek into the South Loop when it's a Bears game on just even on a Sunday at noon.
But it makes for an interesting trip driving up and down Lakeshore Drive.
Right.
Within a mile or two north or south of Soldier Field.
So just anybody who's considering those routes tomorrow night, be forewarned. It'll be smooth sailing today because there's no game. But tomorrow night for the go-home, that'll make Lakeshore Drive real interesting tomorrow night, as well as Roosevelt Road. Yeah.
Always is.
It's always is.
Whether you're walking or driving.
It's always a treat. But, yeah, still, it still amazes me that there's the number of tourists that are still in town from all over the world. There was a group out front of the tower yesterday. Was a group of about 30 people from France. And there was a woman with kind of a headphone thing providing a tour guide view and talking about Tribune Tower. So it was very interesting in my limited amount of French vocabulary to try to pick up what she was saying about the Tribune Tower. But I did hear a journaliste and Liberté.
Okay. Liberté meaning freedom.
Freedom, First Amendment, I assume, mm-hmm. Something along those lines. So, but yeah, just still all, like I said, I thought Labor Day weekend, that would be kind of it. And it's just...
I've noticed visitors around as well, you know, and, you know, with no kids, because the kids are back in school. But, you know, if people have the opportunity to travel, we've done a lot of our traveling either in May or September because the crowds have thinned out a little bit. And may be able
sense.
To get around a little easier if you can do it. And
maybe it's not viewed as seasonal, so you're not paying the highest.
You're not paying the highest rate for things. That's right. Yes. And fall, I think, is a spectacular time to go around the Midwest with we have to offer here, just in terms of milder weather, not to mention the color.
Right.
So
right.
People come here to see this. I know when we were up in May in northern Michigan at Sleeping Bear Dunes
yes.
National Lakeshore, the director there was saying, you know, the color that we have up here in the fall time is fantastic. You know, you don't necessarily have to go to New England to experience spectacular color. They have it there.
Oh, yeah, and as well as in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, northern Wisconsin has to be fabulous.
Right, right, yeah. Right. But we still have
Have it right here.
We've got a warm week ahead, though, don't we?
We do, yes. In the 80s, today and tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so this is one of those, once again, you know, using phrases that we use all too often, but it's very true. Get out and enjoy it because it won't be here. That much longer. Tuesday, looking at a little cooler, the mid-70s. Wednesday, a chance of rain, but other than that, some sunny skies is there, 79. So, yeah, you've got temperatures in the mid to upper 70s and around 80 here. Perfect.
So enjoy it, and as we always say, time is fleeting.
Time is of the essence.
And we'll be having some very interesting weather forecasts a few months from now, I'm sure.
Yes. Yes, we will.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news and sports. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And Engineer Bob is putting the W flag in the window here in the Allstate Showcase studio. You can always find our podcasts, our shows, just by going to iTunes and search for my name, Rick Pearson, or you can go to WGNradio.com. We've got a very special show today. After Dave's 7:30 news update, we'll speak to State Senator Michael Hastings of Tinley Park. The Democratic lawmaker was the sponsor of the now-vetoed bill to raise the minimum pay for home health care workers. Dave will be back at the top of the hour with a news update, and then we'll be speaking to State Representative David McSweeney, a Republican from Barrington Hills, and we'll talk to him about what's at stake in the November 8th legislative elections. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by Sam Toya, the president and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association. We'll talk about the upcoming Chicago Gourmet Fest, what a foodie town like Chicago means to tourism and the city's economy. And we'll also talk about some of the regulatory hurdles that exist for running a restaurant in Chicago. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Yes, the Cubs are on their way, and we'll be on our way to Wrigley Field this afternoon. And beautiful day for it. Time now for our weekly spin through national politics. And as I said, what a wild week it was last week, going from pneumonia to birtherism to a threat of violence. Well, we've got it all covered. I want to start first with some of Donald Trump from a rally he held in Miami on Friday night. Trump has faced criticism over these rallies for trying to incite violence. But on Miami, he took that to a kind of different level when he had a suggestion for the Secret Service agents surrounding Hillary Clinton.
I think that her bodyguards should drop all weapons. They should disarm. Right? Right? I think they should disarm immediately. What do you think? Yes? Yes. Yeah. Take their guns away. She doesn't want guns. Let's see what happens to her. Take their guns away. Okay? It'll be very dangerous.
It'll be very dangerous. That's the Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, on Friday night. Now, let's go back to the start of the week, where Trump seemed to have adopted a more muted tone when the issue of Hillary Clinton's bout with pneumonia came up. This after he having continually questioned whether she has the stamina to be president.
You know, it was interesting because they say pneumonia on Friday, but she was coughing very, very badly a week ago, and even before that, if you remember. This wasn't the first time. So it's very interesting to see what is going on. I want her to get better. I want her to get out there. I look forward to seeing her in the debate. I will say this, the scheduling, you know, if you look at my scheduling and compare it to anybody else's scheduling, it is not a contest. So, you know, I found the whole challenge to be very invigorating because, you know, it's about make America great again. That's what we're doing. We're going to make America great again.
So that's Donald Trump talking about Hillary Clinton's bout of pneumonia. Clinton, after stumbling at last week's 9/11 commemoration ceremony, took a few days off the campaign trail, but was back on Thursday, and she addressed her illness.
As the world knows, I was a little under the weather recently. The good news is my pneumonia finally got some Republicans interested in women's health.
Now, illness aside, both Clinton and Trump went after each other last week We have 50 days left until the November 8th election. In a new ad, the Democratic candidate says basically she's taking Donald Trump at his own words.
You can't lead this nation if you have such a low opinion for its citizens.
How stupid are the people of the country?
We're building a wall. He's a Mexican.
You got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. What the hell do you have to lose?
If you look at his wife, she had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals.
She's a disgusting pig, right?
I like to punch him in the face.
They're losers.
Loser. Loser.
Disgusting. Stupid.
You can't lead this nation if you have such a low opinion for its citizens.
That's the new Hillary Clinton ad that's airing in some of the swing states around the country. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on this week's edition of The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to State Senator Michael Hastings, Democrat from Tinley Park.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase studio. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Still want to spin a little bit through the national politics of the week. And, of course, you know, as Clinton returned to the campaign trail, she went after Donald Trump on the birther issue and Trump's longstanding contention that he wasn't sure that Barack Obama was born in the United States.
For 5 years, he has led the birther movement to delegitimize our first black president. His campaign was founded on this outrageous lie. There is no erasing it in history. Just yesterday, Trump again refused to say with his own words that the president was born in the United States. Now, Donald's advisors had the temerity to say he's doing the country a service by pushing these lies. No, he isn't. He is feeding into the worst impulses, the bigotry and bias that lurks in our country.
So following those remarks, Trump then called a press conference at his new Washington hotel, which then turned out to be not a press conference. And after giving a commercial for his new hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, and after having several military supporters provide cover for him, this is what Donald Trump had to say.
Now, not to mention her in the same breath, but Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it. You know what I mean. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, of course, it's been widely debunked that Clinton started the birther issue. Some rogue supporters of hers sought to carry it out, but were discredited. And when Trump says he ended the birther issue when Obama released his birth certificate, well, that wasn't true either. Trump spent the next several years questioning where Obama was born, the legitimacy of the birth certificate. So the question is, in those 39 seconds, did Trump do even more damage to his efforts to build credibility with African-American voters? Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is State Senator Michael Hastings, Senator from Tinley Park, a Democrat elected in 2012. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
You are much more awake than I am, I understand. You've been up with the little one.
A seven-month-old at home that wakes up at 4 in the morning. You're a little bit chipper in the morning, especially after he's getting his first tooth.
Oh. Yeah, that's...
I'm two Dunkin' Donuts in right now, so we're doing real good.
Good. I'll just turn the show over to you then, okay? We'll just go nonstop, right? But I wanted to have Mike on because I wanted to talk about the issue of, and I know it's a bill that you sponsored, about the legislation to set like a $15 minimum wage for home health care workers. There was another one for people that care for the developmentally disabled. Those bills were vetoed by Governor Rauner. Fall veto session's coming. Are we going to see an override?
You know, there's negotiations going on right now with the different stakeholders, but just the industry alone, I think it's important to make note that there's a 62% turnover rate for home health care workers. In any industry across America, that's an abysmal turnover rate, and there's a reason for it. A $17,000 a year salary for a home health care worker, that's grossly underpaid for the services they provide.
So discussions are underway. We'll see where that leads, basically.
Right now, there's been negotiations between the unions and the governor's office, and the governor has utilized this economic crisis in Illinois to pretty much hamstring not only home service providers but developmental disability providers as well. And he's doing a masterful job at cutting the, you know, hamstringing these two specific providers. I could just tell you right now that it's extremely sad to see in my community the amount of community providers that are suffering, if not going out of business.
Well, and you know, we've talked on this show in the past, particularly during the period when there wasn't any kind of a budget and as the state has kind of limped along, and you look at these people that do provide these services, they're unique. And as we continue to see kind of the crumbling of the social safety net fabric because of Illinois' budget issues, I don't believe these people come back.
I don't think so either, Rick. This would be, you know, looking at it as a whole, I mean, these people do a yeoman's work. They have to, after someone goes to the washroom, they have to wipe them, they have to bathe them, they have to take them out to get their meds. This is a job that no legislator, if not very few legislators, would even consider doing. I know our governor, if you were to ask him to do some of the services that they had to provide, there's no way that he would ever do it. The sad part about this whole situation is that 50% of home care workers rely on public assistance. They make $17,000 a year, and then they're relying on the state on other services. So my philosophy—
To supplement their lives.
So to give them a raise, especially in this niche field in which they operate— You know, this would get them off public assistance. This would make them have a little bit more pride knowing that they get paid a noble wage for a noble day's work.
This is like workers that we hear about in the private sector that they have full-time jobs, but they don't earn enough, and then they're on the food stamp program.
They are the definition of the working poor. And for me, if we can give somebody a hand up, especially in this niche market— You know, if I'm a senior citizen and I'm living with somebody who's taking care of me, I want to make sure that they're able to take care of me, not have the worries of the world resting upon their shoulders. The home care providers, you know, just with their salary and public assistance alone, you know, it's hard to focus on your job when you're really worried about other things that are going on in your life.
So you look at the turnover that exists among these workers. You look at the budget issues with the state, and it seems like this, we're talking about it, unfortunately, a shrinking pool of people at a time when these services are more in demand than ever.
Not to mention, Rick, I agree with you. I just tell you right now that with home services and the community care program, we save money by having people inside the home community versus institutionalizing senior citizens and disabled people. Just in general, For a home services program, an attendant saves the state approximately $20,000 per person. Think about that. That's a staggering number. In the community care program, it's $25,000 per person. So we're actually saving the state money by putting people in the home versus institutionalizing.
Well, and that's part of why, you know, there's this dichotomy, because everybody knows that it's you know, it's laudable and cost effective to have people, you know, stay in their homes rather than having to deal with hospitals and institutions, those kinds of things. That's kind of a stated goal of this state.
That's for me when, you know, when I heard the governor in his inauguration speech say it's we're going to be caring and compassionate about different things. My moral obligation as a state senator is to take care of the most vulnerable. And when I heard that, caring and compassionate, it rung a bell, and I'm like, this is great. You know, our social services aren't going to be slashed. People aren't going to be sent down in the street. Mental health patients aren't going to be kicked out of the service providers. And the first thing that I see in the first 2 years of the administration is just that. Let's cut the legs out from underneath them, and then let's see how they operate and bleed them out to the point where I don't have to deal with them anymore. And that's what the governor's doing.
Maybe you can give us, you know, you're out every day in your district. Just what you're seeing as far as overall that the social safety net, going, what's going on there?
I would say first, it takes a special person to even go into that industry. And a lot of people are discouraged now from even going into that industry, coming out of college or getting their master's degree. They don't even want to do it anymore because, well, what's the state? State's not going to pay me. I'm not going to make a decent wage. It's the very special people that take those jobs, and I give them all the credit in the world. But a lot of my service providers are suffering, and if you're not under a court order or a consent decree, you're living paycheck to paycheck. And for the state and the comptroller who gives out, you know, the monies very sporadically, although she says it's very transparent, it's not. She does prioritize based on what she thinks the priority should be. I have a service provider in my area just got paid for the first time in 7 months. 7 months, Rich. And it's unbelievable to watch, you know, how the director of that agency maneuvers to find monies, you know, fundraising, lines of credit. Her lines of credit are extended. And she provides a first-class service to suburban residents who need these services. And it's sad.
And you can only get so far with that line of credit. I mean,
a lot of banks aren't even extending lines of credit anymore. They're saying enough's enough.
We're speaking with State Senator Michael Hastings, Tinley Park Democrat. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue in Tribune Tower, joined by State Senator Michael Hastings, Democrat from Tinley Park. We were talking about the veto of legislation to give home health care workers and those who care for the developmentally disabled at least a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And one of the things, Senator, you were talking about is, you know, kids coming out of school, they look at what's going on in Illinois, they don't even want to go into this field, and the unique need for those kinds of people to actually, you know, provide those services. I was going to ask you, you know, we've seen these reports now that we've basically started the college school year about the number of high school students we export to other states versus mm-hmm. those that come into Illinois for higher education. And, you know, it just seems to me that here's another kind of crisis that's brewing. I don't want to get into what's going on at Chicago State University, which is its own set of issues. But, I mean, the state of higher education here seems to be very dire.
So, again, another victim of the budget crisis in Illinois, and which is manufactured by political ideas on both parties. But I would say that, you know, one gentleman holds the budget hostage, and this is just another victim of it. And we're starting to see the results of that. So out of 6 out of the 9 universities in our state, we've seen a reduction in freshman enrollment from 1% to 25%. And when I have conversations with parents in my district, they always ask, what do you think about sending my child to Eastern Illinois? I mean, it's a great institution.
It's a great school.
They got great professors, and it's a great place. But parents are reluctant because, well, what happens if Eastern closes in 2 years? What's going to happen to my child? And it's very, very real for people who are sending their kids to schools. And the safe bet for some of these parents is, well, I'm just going to send my kid to Iowa. I'm going to send my kid to Wisconsin. And then we as a state, we're losing out on that revenue.
And we're also kind of, it's a brain drain kind of situation. And, you know, we're seeing that even on the faculty level, the number of people retiring or just, you know, they've had enough because there's the uncertainty in their lives as well. And in a lot of these communities, you know, you look at Eastern in Charleston, it's an economic driver.
As a guy who has an MBA from the University of Illinois, I will just tell you, I have a lot of different conversations with professors. There's a distinct difference between the way the state of Massachusetts incentivizes their professors to come to their universities, and there's a way that Illinois doesn't do it. When we were talking about the pension issue, my first year when I took office, one of the bills I presented was from the state university retirement system itself. All the university professors got together, and it was restructuring that individual system to incentivize professors to come to Illinois. And right now, they're not incentivized to come to Illinois. There's some great academic institutions here, which draw them just by their natural nature, but we could do a better job at that. It's just this budget crisis is hamstringing us, and I'm just asking for our governor to come around. He's going to wait until November to see how it plays out, but that's just not the right way to do business. That's not the right way to govern.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome, as always, to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning, Rick, and congratulations to you and your great team for 3-year anniversary.
It wouldn't be right to celebrate 3 years unless you called. You know that?
Thank you. Senator, there's two things. First of all, the workers, are they represented by the union as far as having any collective bargaining advantage? And also, a bigger question, certainly we want people to make a livable wage, but, Senator, where is the revenue going to come to? You know, this Illinois politics reminds me of 40 years ago. I used to be on the bus of the old three-car Monty trick. I mean, eventually we're going to have to generate some revenue. I know they're waiting possibly after the November election, but no matter how that turns out, you have to come up with the money. The state is in a deficit. So maybe you can address those two things. But thanks. Have a good day, Rick.
Thank you, Ron.
Ron, thanks for calling in. I wanted to make a quick note. There's 88% of the workforce is women, and it's a disproportionate people of color. There's 51% that aren't white or Caucasian. They don't have health insurance under the governor's plan. They don't have a fixed training plan under the governor's plan. And also making $17,000 a year is unacceptable to me. They do have a union. They are negotiating with the governor's office. But, you know, sometimes when the governor's office doesn't want to negotiate, the legislative body has to come in, and that's where checks and balances of our government is, and that's my role as a legislator. And I think it's necessary that if he's not willing to negotiate, then we'll legislate it. And that's the way that, you know, if negotiations break down, that's the way I know how to fix something. Now, in terms of revenues, you know, Illinois has a revenue problem, and we've had a revenue problem since the income tax and corporate income tax have rolled back. And I know with the overall collective budget discussion, there's going to have to be a revenue discussion, because if you're to cut all these services, you know, Illinois will be the last place where people want to live. And to me, that's unacceptable. People should want to come to this great state. People should want to work here. And people, moreover, should have to or be able to earn a decent wage.
In dealing with revenue, I get the sense that no one wants to do a lame duck legislative solution here, that it's going to be a straight up whatever happens, but after the first of the year. Is that your sense of anything?
You know,
if we get that far?
I always look at it this way. The next milestone, or in the military we would say the next 50-meter target, is the November election. And after that will determine a lot of different things in terms of the way the course of Illinois will go. So I'm shooting at the 50-meter target right now, and if I think if we can get a certain amount of wins, I think things will be a lot better for Illinois.
Real briefly, I wanted to ask you about legislation we've talked about previously, which dealt with the way local governments could go after uncollected taxes that are owed. Can you refresh us on that issue and where we're at on that thing?
So the Department of Revenue is the agency that collects the taxes in the state of Illinois. And certain towns, when you shop at a Walmart, say in Tinley Park, sometimes the sales tax that you get in Tinley Park may go to Schaumburg by error of the Department of Revenue. So my point of view and what we're going to go ahead and do in the next legislative session is I want to be able to audit the Department of Revenue. If my tax money in Tinley Park is going to Schaumburg, I should be entitled to get my tax money back. And towns across Illinois have tried to do this. They've been successful in certain ways in doing it. It's a way that towns can get the money that they're rightfully owed. Now, the Department of Revenue makes mistakes, Rick. Let me just tell you this. They gave out $168 million in personal property replacement tax to wrong towns and forms of government across Illinois. So if you don't think that the Department of Revenue makes mistakes and doesn't need to be called on it and have some check on them, I think you'd be misguided. I think something's, you'd be disillusioned. There's so much money that's, mishandled or misdirected, I think it's important that we put a check and balance on them.
But that's all kind of electronically done, isn't? Is it systems? What's the problem at revenue?
There's systems. There's personnel errors that take place through these audits, which doesn't happen. These audits would determine, okay, well, here's where the money is. Here's where the money going. You know, how do we get the money to where it's supposed to go? Whether that's through coding errors. Our IT system in Illinois is antiquated. If you ask any state agency, they will tell you the same thing.
There's a shock.
One of my initiatives over the next 4 years is not only to modernize, our IT across the board, but also to mobilize services and modernize some of our laws as well.
We've been speaking with Michael Hastings, Senator from Tinley Park, Democratic Senator from Tinley Park. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning, and maybe you'll get a chance to get a little nap in this
afternoon. You wake up early, so if you want to come over at 4 in the morning and feed the baby, you're more than welcome to come over, my friend.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that offer. I really appreciate it.
I see you tomorrow.
Cool. You're on. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with State Representative Dave McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson here for the second hour of the Sunday Spin, a special Sunday Spin, our third anniversary Sunday Spin. And once again, all of you out there, thank you so much for listening. On Friday, President Obama held a meeting pushing support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. Now, this is something that you're finding Democrats like Hillary Clinton are actually opposing. But among those visiting the White House, very interesting, was one-time Donald Trump rival for the Republican nomination, Ohio Governor John Kasich.
I get reactions like, well, you're a Republican. Why are you supporting something that the president wants? I mean, we cannot get to the point in America that because a Democrat wants something that you happen to agree with, you can't agree with them. There's plenty of things that I disagree with President Obama on. But the idea that I'm a Republican and therefore I can't work with Democrats, or you're a Democrat and you can't work with Republicans, how does anybody think that the issues of debt, Social Security, Medicare, health care, any of these issues are going to be resolved when we spend all of our time fighting with one another?
That's Ohio Governor John Kasich, a Republican, going to the White House to support the president on the TPP. Well, joining me now on the phone is Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick, and the Hawks preseason starts next week.
I kind of like this blending of the Cubs. Now we know they're going to have at least some postseason, hopefully a lot of postseason,
right.
And then we roll right into the Blackhawks season. And I've been watching a little bit of that World Cup tournament, by the way. Don't be fooled. But hopefully that kind of takes us out of our dependence on the Bears.
Well, this is going to be a tough year for the Bears, but I think the Hawks and the Cubs, it should be great.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough year for the Blackhawks, too. We shouldn't forget that as well. Representative, I wanted to talk kind of in a grand overview about the stakes in the legislative elections on November 8th. And, yes, we know that, about 60% of those races for the 118 House seats and the 40 Senate seats that are on the ballot this time, 60% of those are basically non-competitive. But nevertheless, there's a lot at stake in this election.
Oh, there sure is. In fact, the election on November 8th will decide, I think, the direction that we're going to head in this state. The governor has invested a great deal of money. It's at $20 million as of Friday night. The unions have come in from all over the country to support the Democrats. So they're at least, Rick, 10 competitive races. And as you know, right now it's 71-47. The Democrats have a supermajority. We need one seat, and it's just imperative that we at least pick up one seat to break that supermajority in the House.
When you look at the fact that you mentioned this, the governor's personal investment into these legislative races, you do have, obviously, this is the first time that Republicans have the financial resources in my memory to compete with the union and trial lawyer resources that the Democrats have. But that having been said, it's primarily a one-person funding source.
The governor has provided, through his campaign, a great deal of the resources so that we're competitive this election cycle, and it's going to be a very, very interesting year. We obviously have the presidential race on top, so you'll have a greater turnout. And then, as I said, you probably have, you know, about 10 competitive seats. I think we're going to pick up one seat for sure. Jack Franks, who has been a frequent guest on your show, is running for a McHenry County board. We should pick up that seat.
That's a very, very Republican-leaning district.
It is. So I'm going to call that one right now for us. But then there are about 9 other races that are really just on the bubble. It's too close to call.
And you know, everybody points to that November 8th as where do we go from here? And even with that, though, and regardless of which side may pick up seats, I'm not real confident that we're going to get anywhere, that that's going to change anything. Do you think it will?
I understand that concern, and I have the same issue. Right now, the budget deficit is increasing every day. You know, the stopgap has proven to be a failure. The deficit is now projected to be $8 billion, and that was before the change in the pension assumption. So $8.5 billion deficit, and we're not funding some of our basic social services, and people are talking about a massive tax increase. We actually, Rick, you know, even though it's political season, should be in Springfield working on a budget, because just because we have this stopgap doesn't mean everything is great. It means that the deficit is increased, and we're still not funding some basic social services.
Well, and that's one of the things I'm concerned about. And as we said before, that the stopgap was kind of viewed as, on both sides, everybody kind of taking a time out. We'll let everybody go do their electioneering, their campaigning, and then we'll see what's left after the dust settles November 8th. But there really isn't anything going on as far as trying to find a direction for the future of the budget and the future for the state's finances right now.
Well, to put in context, the unpaid bills number, that's not debt. That's like, you know, unpaid credit card bill, is $8.7 billion. And that's supposed to grow to $14 billion. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, a lame duck session and some grand bargain. I don't see it. I really don't. And I never, Rick, could explain to my constituents why the state would raise taxes when we as legislators have created the problem by not passing the budget. Just to put it in context again, is the budget deficit, the unpaid bill number was $3 billion. Now it's $8.7 billion. The budget deficit last year was forecast at $4 billion. Now it's forecast at $8 billion. That means that we continue, and the two big items are really pensions and Medicaid that are out of control, and there have been no reform. So there's no way this tax increase talk really has become a self-fulfilling prophecy. People said about a year and a half ago, well, we're going to have a tax increase, and then we didn't do anything about spending, so now the bills continue to pile up. So it is a fiasco, and the stopgap has been one of the worst failures that I've seen in Springfield, and the deficit continues to increase every day.
I do have to say, though, I do sense some reticence to do a lame duck kind of tax increase after, you know, in kind of the way it was done in 2011. I don't get that sense that particularly Democratic legislators want to go through that exercise in a lame duck session.
Well, I hope you're right, and because I think the major tax increase would be a disaster for families and small businesses. But one of the other things that's already started, and we're not even through November 8th, is there's already talk about a gubernatorial election. So if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, the Democrats in 18 will be on the defensive. So I doubt that many of them will want to vote for a tax increase, meaning the rank and file. Certainly the Democratic leadership would support a tax increase, but I don't think it would be easy to get 60 votes in the House for a tax increase.
We're speaking with Dave McSweeney, State Representative Republican from Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this bright and sunny Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson, joined on the phone with Dave McSweeney, state representative, Republican from Barrington Hills. We're talking about the stakes, the big stakes that exist in the November 8th election. And Representative, you've talked before about your adamant opposition for a tax increase. And obviously, we've been discussing how the debt is, the budget deficit just keeps growing here. Are you still of that belief that we can get by without a tax increase? And also, your remedy for trying to do something with the pensions?
Yeah, I think one thing we know for sure, Rick, is that we have to address the pension and Medicaid issue. That's where the spending increase. And I think we still can avoid a tax increase. But again, because we're not doing our jobs and we're not adopting a budget, the deficit is increasing every day. So on the pensions, two parts of it. Number one, is President Cullerton, I think, has a good proposal, which I believe is constitutional, which gives workers a choice of having their future salary increases counted toward calculating their pensions. And if they want that, they have to accept a lower cost of living adjustment. That's where the real problem is in the cost of living adjustment, which is growing at 3% compounded per year. And then the second part of it, and the Supreme Court has clearly said that it is constitutional, is I think we have to restructure or reamortize the pension debt. We, in 1995, adopted a schedule that is arbitrary. It's a 40-year schedule that I think we can actually right now restructure. So the combination on pensions and then on Medicaid, we need to protect the truly needy, but we need to fight for more federal money. We need to go for more federal waivers. We need to reduce the payments that are in the system, and we also need to accelerate moving people to the HMOs. But again, the most frustrating part of what's happening now in the state is, as I'll say again, because we passed that stopgap, which is a total failure, because we're not addressing the spending side, the problem's becoming worse. But you have to address pensions and you have to address Medicaid, and we haven't done any of that for years.
On that pension proposal, which, of course, we really haven't seen, we know kind of a framework, but we haven't seen any language. But, you know, one of the questions being that even with those changes and the offering of, quote, consideration in that way, the legal kind of theory, but even doing that, whether in offering a choice, if workers don't have to be offered the choice that says, I want what I have right now. And there's some question about whether that also has to be part of the consideration.
Well, the good news on the consideration theory is that in the ruling by the Supreme Court in the Chicago pensions, where they struck down the law, they did offer a little bit more optimistic vision, I think, on
the a little guidance,
which I is positive. So it's not a slam dunk, I agree, but we have to try. And that's where the growth is, really, these cost of living adjustments. And it continues to again, literally increase every day that we don't address it.
But at the same time, that we're going to have, it will go to be litigation. I mean, it will definitely go to litigation, and, you know, that can take some time.
It could actually take up to 18 months. That's why I believe you have to combine that with restructuring the pension debt, that schedule, that amortization schedule. That has to be a part of it, because you would not be able to realize immediate savings on the pensions. You'd have to wait 12 to 18 months to actually include those savings. If we had adopted the Cullerton model, even after the Chicago ruling, you know, we'd be 3 to 6 months into it right now. Instead, we haven't even started. That's the most frustrating part.
And I wanted to ask you, too, there was the issue of a rate of return, a return on investment, and which has been topical lately. And we had the recent decision by the teacher's retirement system to reduce the annualized expectation for rate of return from 7.5% to 7%. And this was a move that the governor's office was actually opposed to, which also would seem to run counter to his repeated warnings that you can't keep kicking the can down the road. And, you know, we know, as a matter of fact, that return on investment by pension systems is going to be lower than ever. And in fact, if you want to be realistic about it, even probably 3% return on investment is optimistic these days. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I support a complete reamortization of the pension schedule, and combined with that, you know, reevaluating the rate of returns. I mean, Moody's, the rating agency, looks at about a 5.5% rate of return. So our liabilities are much greater than they are. But the problem I have, and I think the governor's office had, is the way that they did that. I mean, it just came on the agenda, you know, on a Friday morning, and they voted on it. So I think a combination of restructuring the pension debt schedule, doing President Cullerton's pension proposal, and redoing the assumptions on rate of return, doing everything at once is the way to do it. My issue, and I think the governor's office issue, is that they did this thing without a lot of public notice and just as an isolated event, as opposed to combining it with a fundamental reform of pensions.
And, of course, there's a tremendous cost involved in that as well by lowering that assumption.
About another $485 million. So the $8 billion number that was created by this stopgap measure, that deficit now is $8.5 billion for the current fiscal year, and it's growing every day.
Yeah, and I mean, and obviously we know that pensions are eating up an ever-increasing amount of the, unobligated money is now becoming obligated, and of course, the continued questions about that shortchanges funding for other types of services. But at the same time, you know, you do have the union saying that, you know, this is a guarantee, this was a promise, and we have the court rulings as well, and it creates this uncertainty that exists out there.
Well, it does, but that's why we need to keep addressing it until we get it right, Rick. There's no way that we can go on like this without, you know, addressing the pension issue. You said it's crowding out basic social services. We're still not funding some of the social, you know, service contracts for, you know, the needy, and that's an absolute disgrace. You know, the stopgap measure picked winners and losers, and we also have a situation that we're not fully funding, you know, higher education. The Tribune has written articles about what's going on at universities with the declining enrollment. I mean, it's an absolute disgrace. And then I pick up the paper the other morning, and I see they're paying $600,000 to get rid of the Chicago State University president. It's another outrage. I mean, when kids are being forced to leave school and they're paying out $600,000 severance contracts, this state is just in a total mess at this point, and we just need fundamental change.
Representative, I'm not sure we can make it till November 8th. I really have days like that. Dave McSweeney, State Representative Republican from Barrington Hills, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Thank you, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Sam Toya. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association. We'll talk about the upcoming Chicago Gourmet Festival, as well as some of the political hurdles that exist in trying to run a restaurant in the city of Chicago.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on a beautiful, sunny Sunday morning. It's 8:36 on this Sunday morning. You've heard during some of Dave's newscasts mentioning a replacement for State Senator Matt Murphy, who resigned effective September 15th. I had Senator Murphy on the show, and I just wanted to let you know that he is actually going to become a government relations person for MAC Strategies Group, which is a strategic communications, public affairs, and government relations firm. And that's where Senator Murphy is headed to. It was a resignation of his own choice as he decides to move on and move out of government. But he'll still be involved with government, only he'll be doing it working for MAC Strategies Group. So just wanted to update you on that. We didn't get to that last week when we talked to former Senator Matt Murphy. Well, joining me now on the phone is Sam Toye. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association. And, Sam, this is kind of one of my favorite times of the year. It's Chicago Gourmet coming up next weekend. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rick. And, yes, it is. We're about 5 days away. Next Friday, kickoff of Chicago Gourmet. It's our ninth year at Millennium Park, and we can't wait.
Oh, and Rick Bayless, you've got a host chef, first time you've ever done that.
That's right. So our theme this year is food is art, use your palate. And it's the first time ever we have a host chef. It's Rick Bayless. And we all know Rick from his television TV programs, his cookbooks, his countless James Beard Awards. He's won six of those. His legendary restaurants, Frontera Grill, Shoko, his new restaurants, Lina Brava, the Cruz Blanca, the name of his two new restaurants. And he'll be our host chef. And he's got some unbelievable ideas. On Saturday night, he's doing this Tao of Tacos with his chef friends. And that's going to be really fun.
That sounds great. And Jimmy Banos at the Junior at the Purple Pig's involved in that.
So the Tao of Tacos is going to be Saturday night, September 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. And obviously our host chef, Rick Bayless, will be hosting. And he has his chef friends doing their take on a taco. And some of the chefs involved, like you say, Jimmy Banos is involved. Jose Garces is involved. Richard Sandoval, Mindy Gore, Erling Wu Bauer, to name a few. So there's 12 chefs that are involved, and they'll be giving their take on on a taco. And then some of the proceeds are going to the Frontera Farm Foundation, because, you know, at Chicago Gourmet, we do a lot for foundations and non-for-profits and, you know, giving back to the community. So the Frontera Farmer Foundation will be participating in Tao of Tacos on Saturday night.
Well, I love that. Food is art. Use your palate. Very clever. I wish I had thought of that.
You like that?
Yeah. I wish I had thought of that. But yeah. There is a charitable aspect to this event.
Yes, there is a charitable aspect. So obviously, I just told you, Frontera Farmer Foundation's part of it. Pilot Light is part of it. We do a Rise and Shine Gourmet. That's on Sunday morning. And Matthias Murchis is a big part of that. And then that benefits the Pilot Light, which is a charitable organization that works with the Chicago Public Schools. And we also have the Illinois Restaurant Association Educational Foundation that's involved all weekend long. And at the Hamburger Hop, like last year alone, the Ed Foundation, Illinois Restaurant Association Ed Foundation, gave out $176,000 in scholarships to students.
Yeah, that's
in the hospitality industry.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before, but why is Chicago just so unique as this kind of center of the food universe?
Well, you know, Rick, I think it has to do. Okay, so it's Chicago, San Francisco, New York, possibly New Orleans. Those will probably be your four biggest culinary epic centers. I think we are the culinary capital. And the reason why is if you look at San Francisco, it's a small city. You look at New York, it's very expensive. And Chicago, it's easy for young talent to come to Chicago and open restaurants. Look at the restaurants we got opening in Logan Square and Avondale and Hyde Park, the West Loop. Just look at the West Loop.
The West Loop is crazy. The West Loop is crazy.
Yes. So, you know, young talent comes here. And look what we do for the food industry. We have Chicago Gourmet, which I say is the best food and wine show in the country. They think they have the best one in Pebble Beach or South Beach. Nope, it's right here in Chicago every September in Millennium Park next weekend. And also we have the National Restaurant Association show as well, which brings up close to 70,000 people in the industry into Chicago every year in May. And then a few years ago, Mayor Emanuel was very, very big on this, and we brought in the James Beard Awards here, which are the Oscars of the culinary industry, and that's huge too. So we get all the people from the industry, all the chefs and all the journalists coming to Chicago every year for the last few years now for the James Beard Awards. So James Beard Awards, Chicago Gourmet, the National Restaurant Association show, we have it all here in the city of Chicago. And look at some of the talent we have. Stephanie Iser, Rick Bayless, Jimmy Banos, as you were saying, Graham Elliott, Tony Montuano, Erling Wu Bauer, just to name some of the talent we have in this city.
Well, and, you know, and things like the National Restaurant Association, they choose to come here. You know,
that's right.
And so
that's, right.
That's kind of a huge affirmation for the culture of food that exists in this city.
That's exactly right. You know, what's it all about these days? It's about conventions, tourism, and culinary tourism. And culinary tourism is off the charts. Majority of the people that travel now, Rick, look at what restaurants are in that city. The back half of the plane is all about tourism. And, you know, look at cities like, you know, Austin or Nashville or Charleston, Charlotte. They built their tourism on culinary tourism. But we got the best culinary tourism right here in the city of Chicago. Look at the city of Chicago. We are the best summer fall city in the country to travel to.
Well, and when you touched on some of the, you know, other cities, and you touched on New Orleans and you know, Nashville too, but it's more of a distinctive local cultural. I mean, I love my barbecue, and I love my Cajun.
That is absolutely true.
But here, it's just, it's whatever you want is what's amazing about it.
Whatever you want. I mean, you know, look at, you know, Stephanie doing Duck Duck Goat, you know, her take on Chinese. Or, you know, we have, you know, some of the greatest steakhouses. We have, you name it, we have it here in the city of Chicago. And like I said, we have some of the best chefs in the country with the number one, you know, godfather of all chefs these days, Rick Bayless. So what you want, you can get it in Chicago when it comes to the culinary scene.
And I have no better fun than when I run into people that are, you know, some of the tourists that are here or there are conventioneers here. And you get these great debates about, you know, well, you're local, where should we go eat? And you get into these great debates over everything.
Well, but then you got to break it down.
Well, the first question is, what do you want? And then the debate still ensues because there are so many, you know, multiple options to go with.
That's why Chicago Gourmet is so important, because we have over 250 restaurants participating this year, so people can come and get tastings from over 250 restaurants. Then they can decide what restaurants they would like to go to when they go out next. So that's, you know, that's the big thing. And you can taste wines from Southern Glazer Wines and Spirits. They have wines throughout the world that you can get your wine tasting as well. So Chicago Gourmet, if you want to be, you want to know what's the best wines out there and what the best restaurants, come to Chicago Gourmet next weekend. You'll get educated very well.
It's the gourmet graze for me, I will tell you. Sam, there's still tickets available, right, for some of this?
There is. There is tickets for the Hamburger Hop on Friday night. And there's also tickets for Sunday during the day. So yes, and you can go online and check that out at chicagogourmet.org. And like I said, we have Sunday tickets and we have Hamburger Hop on Friday night. Hamburger Hop is something really big too. That's 15 chefs participating on Friday night, and they're, you know, cooking who has the best burger. Some of the chefs involved there are like Chris Pandel, Swift and Son, Matt Wild, the Joy District, Manny Downing, a Rocket Ranch, to name a few. So they do a cook-off of the best burger. That is so much fun, and the energy there is off the charts. And that's sponsored by Buckhead Beef and Blue Moon Brewing. So it's really fun.
Oh, I'm hungry already, I have to tell you. Sam, hold on. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. This is The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined on the phone by Sam Toya, the president and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association. We've been talking about the upcoming Chicago Gourmet Festival, my favorite festival in the world, because everybody knows I'm a foodie. But Sam, I also wanted to have you on too about, you know, there's an intersection of food and politics, and that I think comes with, you know, running a restaurant in the city of Chicago. And
that's absolutely right.
You look at some of the issues confronting business owners in the city of Chicago, things like the higher minimum wage, property tax increases, other regulations about mandated leave policies, things like that. These can't be easy times.
No, Rick, you're absolutely right. You know, we at the Illinois Restaurant Association, we rather see these labor standards set at the national level. And if they're not at the national level, then we really like to see them set at the state level, so you have uniformity, because business likes to see uniformity. However, we see some of these labor standards now being adopted at the municipality level. And, you know, there's no question we're in a blue city and a blue state. So we know in the restaurant industry that it's better to be at the table than on the table. So what we try to do is, like I said, try to push mandates to be done at the national or state level. If not, then we try to get the most business-friendly ordinance that comes out of whatever they're talking about. That's what's been going on lately. But there's no question, from the property taxes to the entry-level wages to the paid sick leave, there's been a lot of hit on the hospitality industry over the last year.
You know, I'm speaking to a restaurateur when you use a term about politics of better to be at the table than being on the table.
Yes. <It's>,
but
that's kind of like my food is art, use your palate.
Yes, yes. But I mean, this is a vibrant and vital part of the economy in Chicago and the state.
Absolutely, and the state. In the state, there's 537,000 people that work in the restaurant food industry. There's over 27,000 restaurants, and we do $24.5 billion in sales. And look at this, over $2 billion in sales tax to go to local municipalities and to the state. Look at that. In the city of Chicago, there's over 300,000 people that work in the restaurant food service industry. There's over 12,000 retail food licenses. So, yes, it's a huge part of both the Chicago and the state of Illinois economy.
And, you know, when people – I don't know if people think of restaurants under that rubric of small business, but that is the small businesses that do create the jobs.
Oh, absolutely they are. They're the entry-level jobs. It's just the one of the – few industries that you could still enter, Rick, and get to a middle-class lifestyle. There's many of people that start out working as dishwashers and busboys that go on to own their own restaurants or become general managers of restaurants. So it is it's the entry-level, it's where a lot of people entry-level jobs, and entry-level jobs are very important to the economy.
And when you look at those 537,000 jobs, restaurant food service jobs in Illinois, that's 10% of the total employment in this state. 10%.
That's right. 10%.
I mean, that's a phenomenal number. And here again, a very important factor of what makes the economy work. But that having been said, there's also the issue, too. And as you said, you would prefer uniformity on a national level on various things. Well, one of those things is the issue of immigration reform. And
that's right.
And obviously a big part of the presidential debate, but this state and bipartisanly, people, leaders in this state support comprehensive immigration reform.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a few minutes. So immigrants have always been the backbone of the hospitality industry, starting over the last 100 years, starting with the Eastern Europeans, the Italians, the Greeks, the Asians, the Africans, the Latinos, and the Mexicans. The restaurant industry would not be what it is today without the immigrant community. This is, you know, so the immigrant community is huge, huge to the hospitality industry, you know. And people don't understand that, you know, if you say, oh, we're going to remove all the undocumented, what would that do to the hospitality industry throughout the country? You know what people don't realize? What would that do to the real estate industry throughout the country? A lot of the immigrants are renters. People never go down that road, Rick. You got to think about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we work very closely with the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition and their executive director, Rebecca Shee. I'm on that board as well because it's our job to go out there and educate. Like, we worked on the DREAM Act. We also, you know, giving undocumented students an opportunity to get a higher education. We worked on temporary visitor's driver's license, which was huge. Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton were very much behind that, you know, so people could get to, you know, drive to work, schools, church, without a fear of breaking the law.
And that did get bipartisan support as well. That got Republican support as well.
Yes, it did. You know, in the state of Illinois, we definitely are pragmatic on this issue. It's one issue that I think we are, from, you know, Governor Rauner all the way down, that immigration reform is very important to the state of Illinois.
The unfortunate part is, though, that when it comes to the national level, it becomes a political football.
Very much so. And it's just, you know, and to do, you know, this is what I don't understand, because it's so important we do immigration reform because it's economically sound, it's morally right, and it's politically smart. So I just don't understand why some elected officials throughout the country just don't understand that.
Except perhaps because it fits a perceived political agenda.
Well, obviously, that's why, Rick.
Okay, I said it so you didn't have to.
That's right.
Well, Sam Toya, President and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association, thank you so much for joining me. Speaking of immigration, the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition is having an event tomorrow at 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. at La Casa, the Resurrection Project at 1815 South Paulina Street. And that features U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Congressman Luis Gutierrez, and as well as Congresswoman and Democratic Senate candidate Tammy Duckworth. Sam, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me, and we'll see you next week. I can't wait to have a glass of wine with you.
I can't wait either. Good talking to you. All right. We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Senator Mike Hastings, State Representative Dave McSweeney, and Sam Toya, President and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association. Very quickly, I also want to make a quick pitch for a fundraising event that's coming up Thursday, September 29th, 6 to 8 p.m. at McGee's Tavern, 950 West Webster. It's for Baton Rouge flood relief. You've heard me talk about that all the time on this show, that the people in Baton Rouge truly haven't gotten the recognition for all the damage they suffered from all the flooding there. But you can help out at this fundraiser. You can find more information about this and the proceeds, where they'll be headed to, including the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. You can go to GoFundMe.com/Eileen Taylor. GoFundMe.com/Eileen Taylor. We'll see about putting a link on our page here at WGN Radio. But thanks for any help you can take part in. And Dean?
That's nice.
Good to see you.
Nice event. It sounds like it's going to be a nice event.
I think there'll be a silent auction. Yeah. We've got all kinds of goodies that we're compiling here.
Isn't that interesting how, for this kind of devastation and flooding, there really has not been an awful lot of charity events going on.
You don't hear it like there have been with a
lot of them in the past. I hope we're not becoming blasé about, helping people and, tragedies in other parts of the country.
Well, and of course, naturally, the people down there, and I have great friends down there, look at Katrina and all of the attention.
Right.
And that was kind of an ongoing charitable process that existed there. And they, in Baton Rouge, they just kind of feel isolated by it.
Well, sounds like a fantastic event.